Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. This is the third episode we've done dedicated to the maritime history of Africa. If you haven't heard our previous two episodes, please go back and find them in our back catalogue. We have one on the history of indigenous African canoemen, and another on the desolate and vengeful skeleton coast of Namibia, home to thousands and thousands of shipwrecks from centuries of maritime trade, war and exploration, all that passed Namibia's coast. Today we hear about the history of whaling in Africa. We find out about indigenous African whaling as well as European and American exploitation of African waters. We hear about the numerous uses to which whale products were put, both in Africa and abroad, and we talk about the written and archaeological evidence. If you don't know what a tripod is, then please keep listening. My guests who helped teach me about this fascinating topic are Dr. Lynn Harris, who has worked as a maritime historian and underwater archaeologist for over 40 years in South Africa, Namibia, Costa Rica, and North and South Carolina. She's currently employed as a professor at the Programme of Maritime Studies at East Carolina University, one of just a handful of programmes in the world that trains graduate students as underwater archaeologists. And with her, we have Lindsay Wentzel, a third-year master's student in East Carolina University's programme in Maritime Studies. Her MA thesis centres on the use of converted fishing schooners and what is known as plum pudding whaling strategy as an economic response to whaling's decline during the 19th century. And she writes with a particular focus on Provincetown in Massachusetts. But today, they are both here to cast their expertise onto the question of whaling in Africa. As ever, I hope you enjoy listening to them as much as I enjoy talking with them. Here are the excellent Lynn and Lindsay. Guys, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure. In fact, quite an honour to be on your podcast today.
Thank you for having us.
An honour? No, no one's ever said an honour, I don't think. But that's good. So that means we must be doing something right. Let's start with a general question about the history of whaling. Why is it important?
So in terms of the African heritage of whaling, it was one of the major fisheries. And from colonial time onwards, it was a major economic industry behind agriculture and, of course, winemaking in South Africa, which many people don't know about. The other really important aspect of it is that it's a shared whaling heritage. It incorporates indigenous whaling, as well as American, British, as well as Norwegian in the 20th century. So this very international heritage is part of many different cultures' maritime heritages.
Can you explain about the history of wine? What's the link with winemaking?
There were three industries that were the main industries in southern Africa during colonial times. This is 1600s, 1700s with the Dutch and the British. And winemaking and agriculture were the main industries, but whaling was one of those economic industries as well. It's often neglected and in the background as a fishery. It's extremely lucrative.
I see. And what about the sort of the northern story?
So I would add that one of the main importances of African whaling in particular is just the movement of people, especially in Cape Verde. It brought just a ton of immigrants into northern whaling ports like Provincetown and New Bedford, especially from those islands. And we still have communities of Cape Verdeans in Massachusetts today, and it's a really rich culture. And just that movement of people, and really, like Dr. Harris was saying, it's an international industry that impacts a variety of different cultures and a variety of different people. So there's really a lot that you can study through whaling and through that lens of whaling.
I'm quite interested in the way it relates to the history of regulation at sea and people trying to control the industry or people trying to control the sea. Does the history of whaling have an important part to play in that history of maritime regulation?
Yes. From the colonial time onwards, there was competition about whaling charters. For example, in the 1600s, the Dutch West Indies Company received a charter to hunt whales off southern Africa. And so they tended to monopolize that industry. Later on, Americans and other nations joined into the game. And as it became more popular and more lucrative, the whaling stocks started to be depleted. And so what you see happening in terms of environmental history is switching from one whale species to another as it became scarce. And then ultimately whaling legislation being enacted for different species at different times. But ultimately whaling went on in Africa until 1975, which is when it finally was ended with the Endangered Species Act. So some of it was regulated by peoples themselves and communities because there simply were not, for example, humpback and blue whales, which are the big migratory whales. When those stocks were depleted, they started switching to the smaller whales, the more local ones, like the fin and the sei and the minke, and then ultimately the sperm or the southern right whale. And so you see that trend, and that's a really important part of whaling history as well as the environmental aspect of it, mm-hmm. Which is not our really area of expertise, but it does impact what whales they were hunting and who was hunting them at what time.
I'm fascinated in the indigenous practice of whaling in Africa as well. So there are two sides to this story, aren't there? There's the European colonial whaling, but also a pre-existing history of whaling. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So one of the sources we used was the archaeological record, which is fascinating. And they found archaeological evidence in the Khoisan coastal communities along Namibian coastline, as well as South African, of whalebone in deposits, along with other types of shellfish and animal bone, and not only in coastal communities, but also inland. So the speculation is that the coastal peoples were probably scavenging whaling and then trading with inland groups for other types of resources. So that's one. There's a wealth of archaeological reporting material on that. The other is primary sources of early travelers who actually depict and draw and describe these early indigenous peoples' homes, where they built them from whale ribs. So they have structures, frameworks for their huts made out of whalebone, as well as furniture, like whalebone vertebrae that were used for seats, and then palisades or stockades for their livestock, for the sheep and the cattle that they herded along the beach. Another interesting angle to that is the trade that ensued between the local whalers, the Dutch and the American, in the 1700s. So the Europeans, their product was the blubber, but they didn't consume the meat. So they would give the whale carcasses to the Khoisan indigenous people for consumption and often trade it for their sheep or cattle on their beach and other resources. So there was this engagement between the Europeans, the Americans, and the indigenous people, going back to the 1600s and 1700s in these really remote parts of Africa.
So the Khoisan give away their cattle and they get whale blubber, but whale meat in return.
They would trade various other resources for whale meat. The other types of archaeological evidence of indigenous people is And there might be more out there, but the Todzilo Hills in Botswana, which is probably migratory distance from the Namibian coastline, has rock art depicting whales, which gives further evidence to the speculation that there was this trade between inland and coastal indigenous people for them, at least to the extent that they would do artwork on whales in their habitats.
Is there any artwork that depicts ships, or is it just the whales?
No, there is, actually. There's, in South Africa, the Porteville Galleon, which shows a ship with masts. It's eroded, so the details aren't visible, but it's clearly a ship. And there is something in that depiction that looks something like a fish or a whale. It's unclear yet, but there's a strong possibility, you know, that more of these colonial engagement rock art depictions are around as well.
That sounds fascinating. I'd love to see that. Have historians covered this subject well, or are you sort of breaking new ground here?
I would say that history-wise, there's definitely been more of a focus on New England and American-based whaling, not as much in Africa. And I think the issue with that is that we just don't have as many archaeological remains of African whaling. And a problem with that is because these shore-based whaling sites are pretty ephemeral. So actually finding archaeological remains of shore whaling can prove to be difficult sometimes. But what's interesting to me, especially in Cape Verde, is that there's really a modern and active valorization of this intangible cultural heritage. So for example, in 2006, there was a stamp collection issued in Cape Verde based on this history of whaling. There's also rock formations that are referred to as like Anka Balea. I believe that's what they called this certain rock formation still today in Porto Rincão, because it resembles the back of a whale. And there's also, I think Dr. Harris mentioned, there's still local art that's based on the vertebrae and bones. It incorporates the vertebrae and bones of whales that are still used today.
It certainly makes sense for people to be whaling in Cape Verde. Can you just talk about the migratory routes of the whales? Why are they in this area off the African coast?
So there are, actually in Cape Verde, there's almost 24 species of whales that are found along this migratory route. And it's mostly because Cape Verde is a really rich breeding ground for these whales. So there's a lot of access to these different species, and especially humpbacks and baleen whales. And they'll breed around the area of Cape Verde before returning to high latitudes for feeding grounds in the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
So mostly because of breeding grounds, at least in Cape Verde.
Right. So that Gulf of Guinea with warm waters was ideal. And then they would migrate down along the coast of Africa during the summer months of the Southern Hemisphere to Antarctica, which was a very rich feeding ground, or krill, small crustacean. Feed in Antarctica, come back up past through the South Atlantic and then to the North Atlantic back to the breeding grounds. So that was the route of these whales, was up and down the coastline of South Africa. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other whales, in addition to hunting those migratory whales, there were also species like the southern right whale, which was in the colder waters off southern Africa in the South Atlantic. And those whales couldn't survive in the warmer waters. They were adapted to the colder waters. So, again, there was a variety of whales that the indigenous people and the whalers were exploiting, and very aware of their seasonal migratory routes and calving. They were most vulnerable when they came into the bays to calve. So they were, you know, in tune with the whale seasonality and breeding grounds. So, and that most of this was shore whaling, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about Cape Verde and the coast of Namibia and down into South Africa. Did this apply to the whole of the African coast, or were there just sort of hotspots that we know about?
Yes. Our research focused on the Guinea, the northwestern African whaling cultures, and then South Africa. So there probably are other areas, but it is less available in terms of historical and archaeological literature right now. So there's, it is to an extent driven by the available scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So there are gaps to fill in. There's plenty more for other researchers too.
dig into.
Yeah, it's so exciting when you find a new subject like this, which you're only scratching the surface. And actually,
exactly.
You know, when you start getting answers, and you realise you've got to fill in all the other gaps to see whether they're representative or not.
Yeah. Filling in with research gaps, that's kind of what my graduate thesis focuses on. So I'm primarily focused on New England whalers, but specifically plum pudding whaling. I don't know if you've heard of plum...
I don't know what plum pudding... No, I have no idea what that is.
So it's pretty common for people not to know what plum pudding whaling is. But plum pudding whaling is this strategy of whaling which focuses on the Atlantic. And instead of doing these multi-year long voyages, it was really only a couple of months. So like 6 to 9 months or so. And they get the name plum pudding because since they weren't gone for multiple years, they were more easily... They also... weren't as far offshore. They were kind of inshore whaling along the coast of North America, and then they'd also go to Cape Verde and I believe down to the Brazilian banks before heading back to New England to refit and then head up to the Arctic. But anyways, they were always close enough to shore that they could refit and get kind of these indulgences like fresh fruit and make plum pudding. So that's how they got their name. But that's kind of an area of research where I'm focusing on, because I think that plum pudding was used more so after the discovery of petroleum in 1859, because you're able to take smaller vessels, which is more cost effective, and with limited resources and whale oil not pulling as much of a profit as it used to, these shorter voyages are, you're able to pull more of a profit and not expend as many resources to do the same thing you were doing, you know, 10 years ago when whaling was a lot more profitable.
Yeah.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That would have been my type of whaling.
Yeah.
That would have been the kind of boat that I was on. Short and sharp, and I could have some nice food.
Exactly.
I think that really appeals to me. In terms of doing the research, trying to kind of get to the bottom of what was going on, do local modern communities have living memories of whaling practices?
So in Cape Verde especially, there, I think I mentioned a little bit before, but they still have this active valorization of whaling culture. So there's like the stamp collection that was in 2006. They also have geographic locations that are named after whaling. And Dr. Harris has some good examples yeah. of waypoints and geocaches that actually focus right. on whaling.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Simonstown Historical Museum, which is based in Cape Town in False Bay, this was a British naval station. Today is still the South African Navy Station area. But they've collected whaling histories and orals as part of the local community history. It's not exclusively devoted to whaling, but it is part of the economic economics of the area and the maritime history. And it's really exciting. These were small whaling boats, literally whaling boats, rowboats that were taken out with about four oarsmen, a harpooner and a helmsman, to enter the bay. And it was quite a recreational activity for the local community. After they'd harpooned the whale and they would drag down the coast in the small boat, the children and everybody would be sort of running along the cliffs waiting to see what happened to them, whether they'd get dragged out to sea or they'd be successful in their endeavor, and then bring the whale up onto the beach. And then everybody would come down and assist in the process of flensing the whale and boiling up the blubber. So these oral histories are available. And there are also a number of graphics, old photographs that are compiled in this local repository. So I think that's interesting. You know, these were not colonials. They were indigenous people of color during the early 1900s, late 1800s. So that's a good collection of information.
And then it's a little bit out of the scope of our current research, what we're focusing on, but I think it's important to mention these ceremonial practices used in modern whaling. So, for example, in Ghana in 1997, there was a stranded sperm whale that was actually given a customary burial ceremony by local fishermen because of this traditional veneration of cetaceans. And I think that's just really interesting practice because still, in other cases, some whales are still used as marine bushmeat. And it kind of gets a little bit out of the scope of our research, but there's definitely still this modern connection to historic whaling through continued whaling or at least continued veneration of whales themselves.
And respect for the marine environment.
Definitely.
Which that sounds nice. Yeah. You can't actually bury a whale that big, can you?
Yeah.
Doing some interesting symbolic actions. What about material culture, objects? Do we have any interesting surviving material culture?
So in South Africa, of course, you have the ruins or the remains of these whaling stations. One example is a small, almost like a historic house, whaling station in False Bay, which is now part of the South African Resource Heritage Agency historic site. And it's unusual. It's embedded in a local residential community, but it's been preserved. And you can still see the basement, which was where the whaling boats were kept, the platform for the tripods for boiling the blubber, and then the laborers' quarters and the sheds for equipment in the back. So that's one example of something that's been preserved in a modern-day landscape. And then the others are more remote, and they're ruins of these 20th century whaling stations. So between 1900 and 1914, this was the heyday of whaling in South Africa. And so these stations sprouted up all over the place. And there are more ruins, which include the factory, the processing areas, the laborers' quarters. And there are a number of these stations out there that have a very preliminary data set, maybe a map and a designation in a database. But those are all historic sites, historic archaeological sites that could deserve further study. And these were, pretty large yards. They accommodated about 120 workers. It was during the apartheid era of South Africa, where you would see designated on the maps the white laborers' quarters and the black laborers' quarters, and then fairly subsistence labor unit where they would have vegetable gardens and livestock. So it would be a self-supporting industrial unit for processing this whale meat. So that's another example. Might be just remnants in these whaling towns, for example, tripods, which were these gigantic cast iron cauldrons used for boiling up the blubber. And they're, fairly ubiquitous in any small whaling port. You'll see them in front of a store or a museum or in a local street. False Bay has an interesting geocache type of initiative where tourists and the local population can sort of roam around the town and locate historic icons. And one of these geocache areas are the whaling equipment and paraphernalia, for example, the cast iron pot. Other small features in the landscape, sort of footprints of whaling, are the eyebolts, which are along a pier, a popular walking area for the public, and these eyebolts were used to winch up the whale carcasses onto the beach. Another remnant is the cauldron platforms, which were bricked out. Unfortunately, these have been turned into barbecue places or outdoor cooking areas for the public on the beach, but they still, the footprints or the signatures of whaling that are visible to the locals.
So in Cape Verde, there's actually the remnants of a whaling station in São Nicolau. And the Portuguese actually never built a whaling fleet because they viewed the Cape Verdean Islands as not being profitable enough for whaling. So it was mostly dominated by foreign whaling. And then during the mid-19th century, foreign whalers started to leave the islands because of these depleted stocks, and shore whaling from Cape Verdeans actually kind of took over the industry. So there is one station, some remnants of it, on São Nicolau that is still visible today. Other than that, not as much, just because those sites are so ephemeral.
Yeah. It's so exciting, with much more to be discovered in your ongoing research. I very much look forward to hearing about it. Lynn, you actually mentioned to me a separate topic about shipwrecks on the Namibian coast, which I was fascinated by. Can you tell me a little bit about those?
So the one that's related to whaling specifically is Miop Bay, which is a incredibly remote area along the coast of Namibia. And this is a restricted diamond mining area. In 2011, our East Carolina University took a group of students out there to study this area, including the shipwrecks, which are now on land as the coastline has migrated. But one of the sites that our hosting group, the Bintook Underwater Club, was very invested in were these two small boats called the Ladies of Miop, and they resembled the classic American whaling boat. We know American whalers were on this coastline, and they were surrounded by whale bones. We were not sure whether they were whaling boats or diamond mining boats that were used for ship-to-shore transport, and there's a strong possibility they were used for both. So we were involved in preserving these two small boats, putting preservative substances on the hulls with the local community, and learning more about the whaling community and these communities along the shore that conducted whaling, again, most likely American whalers from New Bedford.
It's fascinating the way that the coastline has migrated, as you say. So you end up with shipwrecks in the desert. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this is a shipwreck that is called the Edward Bolin. It's clearly visible on Google Earth maps. It's sort of part of a sand dune now, and it's a really popular tourism site for locals, simply because it's such a unusual feature in the middle of the desert. That was also part of our study trip with our students. We were interested in the history of the vessel as it related to the Nama and Damra wars, the colonial wars, because it was used as an incarceration facility for indigenous peoples. Later on, it became basically a dormitory for miners, for diamond miners. And there are descriptions of travelers who arrived in the desert or new miners, and they sort of saw the ship lit up through the portholes with a lighting system for miners. What's also interesting is when we were there, it was also the residence for a number of animals, like hyenas, who dragged their seal carcasses up into the ship and were now residing in it. So as we came round the corner in our Land Rovers ready to document the ship, we were just assaulted with this smell, and realized once we got to the ship what we were looking at. It was sort of the larder of the local hyena population we were about to enter.
Well, it's a wonderful story. I think I'm going to do some more on that. That sounds absolutely fascinating. I've always been interested in ships that have a second life one way or another.
Yeah. This was about the fourth life of this vessel. And yeah. It was carrying a lot of well-known families to the Namibian settlement. So you have connections with names of families who settled in Windhoek. And the ship paintings and stamp collections abound. Some of the most five-star upscale hotels in Namibia, in Windhoek, which is the capital, have huge paintings of the vessel in their foyers. There was very little understanding or knowledge of the ship's role in its previous life as a prison during the colonial wars or as a diamond mining's residence. So it was also used for, I'm trying to think of that crazy car show.
Top Gear
took their cars and did a spin around the vessel as part of their entertainment series.
And there were a number of British film companies as well as German companies who were very enamored with this location for productions. These were usually romance and a lot of violence. And people would be running around the ship setting up dynamite and these made excellent movies yeah. at that time period.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful story. Listen, thank you both very much for sharing your research on the history of whaling on the African coast. It's fascinating, and I wish you the best of luck as it carries on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, please make sure that this isn't the last thing you do to enjoy the content we produce. We have a huge back catalogue of fascinating episodes to explore, from great naval battles to shipbuilding, ship models, exploration, fishing, maritime art and literature, trade, famous heroes and maritime disasters, among others. Please also do check out our YouTube channel. It is quite simply brilliant. There are numerous innovative videos there presenting the maritime past in an entirely new light. My current favourite being a laser scan of HMS Victory that shows Nelson's magnificent flagship in white lines and grids against a black background. Not only can you fly around the ship, but you can even go inside. Please also remember that this podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation. You can find the History and Education Centre of the Lloyd's Register Foundation at hec.lrfoundation.org.uk and the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk, where you can join up, and please do. There is a free level of membership, but if you're willing to part with a small donation, you get a huge number of benefits, one of which is our winter lecture series, where you can enjoy being entertained and enthralled by some of the finest maritime scholars in the world. You can find all of that at snr.org.uk.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.